Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to Off the Beaten Track podcast. I'm your host, I'm Stu Whiffin. It's another week, therefore it's another episode. Today's episode is Frank Turner. Got to sit down and have a right good chat with Frank, and you're going to absolutely love this episode. We pinball all over the place with conversation, alongside the obvious chats about the records that have been really key to Frank's life. Before we get on with the podcast, just like to say a big thanks to Scroobius Pip and everybody at the Distraction Pieces Network. Big thanks to 76 for producing this podcast. And if it's your first time listening to this, please go and have a rummage in the archives, because you'll find stacks and stacks of podcasts from like some of your favourite musicians, actors, DJs, comedians. Go and have a rummage. You will find something that you like, trust me. And if you really like this and you also want to support it, there's a Patreon page as well where I put standalone episodes up each week over there. I think there's about 150-odd episodes over there to get your teeth into as well. You can find out all about that at www.offthebeatentrackpodcast.com. Shall we get down to today's episode? I can stop this this introduction chit-chatter now and get on with the good stuff. Please enjoy Off the Beaten Track podcast with the wonderful Frank Turner. I've got an announcement. Save Our Souls Clothing. www.sosclothing.co.uk. Why am I telling you this? Because they're our official sponsor. Yeah, that's right. Go and check them out, because their clothing is off the scale. You're going to love it. So they've decided they want to be our sponsor, which is amazing. And what I have to do is I have to tell you about why they're amazing. So here's a little bit of blurb. So they've only been going a year, and they're based in Southend-on-Sea, just up the road from me. They put the company together based on a love of tattoos and alternative music, and they've worked with some of the greatest artists around the world to produce these items of clothing that are as unique as you lot. All of the designs are printed using biodegradable, sustainable and water-based inks. In addition to that, they only print on garments made by members of Fair Wear Foundation. I mean, come on, great clothing and a conscience. Since going live in April last year, they've seen their audience grow massively and are now selling orders all across the world. And they were recognised by Cosmopolitan magazine as one of the best sustainable clothing brands, alongside names such as Stella McCartney. I mean, that's quite a first year, right? So go and check them out, because they've put a lot of love into supporting this podcast, and I couldn't be happier. What else they've done is they've given you 15% off. So if you head over to www.sosclothing.co.uk, do a bit of shopping, see what you like, throw it in the basket, and then on the way out, put in the discount code BEAT15, BEAT15, and that'll save you 15% off. Amazing, right? www.sosclothing.co.uk. Official sponsors of Off the Beaten Track podcast. Let's get back to that podcast. It's Off the Beaten Track podcast on the Distraction Pieces Network. With me, Stu Whiffin. Welcome to Off the Beaten Track podcast, and sitting opposite me today via the means of a Zoom call is Frank Turner. Hello.
Hello. Hi, how you doing?
I'm all right, thank you, Frank. Really appreciate you giving up your time today to come and talk records.
My pleasure. I like talking about records. It was hardly a massive ask.
Okay, well, before we get on with the playlist, I just want to ask you something aside from the tracks that we're going to talk about. And I just wondered how you found the whole weird world we're living in at the moment, in lockdown. How you found it as Frank Turner, the human being, and Frank Turner, the creative?
I guess the first thing I would say is that it's not a single monolithic experience, you know. I think a lot of people talk about, like, lockdowns, if it's just one thing that you'd have one set of feelings about, sure. And that's not been the case for me. The beginning of lockdown was... The very beginning was very weird and quite rough because I was in the middle of a tour and we had to cancel and come home, and that sort of goes against my instincts, shall we say, and obviously is both professionally and financially quite tough as well. So there's that. Then, you know, there was a sort of bit of a honeymoon period, I found, where, you know, it was like, well, there's time with no distractions, we're all in this together, and both of those things turned out not to be true, in my opinion. Partly because there is a distraction, which is a global pandemic. And secondly, because, you know, we're not all experiencing the same thing. I think that people have very different experiences of lockdown, depending on, you know, where they live, their socioeconomic status, whatever it might be, you know, and considering issues like sort of, I don't know, everything from domestic violence to people who are in recovery or whatever it might be, people who live with no outdoor space, people isolating alone. There's lots of different experiences. So within that, despite those bits of it that I've found hard, I've been trying quite hard not to complain, simply because I like where I live and I live with my wife and my cat, and we all like each other, the cat most of the time. Do you know what I mean? And so I think it's important to be kind of self-aware, if you know what I mean. Totally. That's all quite highfalutin. And then I've just been trying to keep busy, really, and have routine and structure. I thrive off having a bit of structure in my life, and there was none at the beginning, which led to quite a long period of time of kind of drinking and Netflix. And after a while, you're kind of like, this isn't really like a model for life for an extended period of time. But I've been writing songs. I built a guitar. I have been learning how to mix audio. It's been fun.
Oh, wonderful. Wonderful. Well, Frank, let's get on with the playlist. And I'm going to ask you for track one to tell me the song that you think has the greatest ever intro.
I'm just looking up what my actual answers to this I wrote down were. So the song that has the greatest intro, I mean, there are many, but I went for what for me is the easy choice, which is Bat Out of Hell by Meatloaf.
Okay.
Partly because it's just got one of the longest intros ever. Do you know what I mean? It just keeps introing for such a very, very long time. And it's all gravy, in my opinion. So, if you're going for an intro, you might as well sort of max out your... your possibilities. What I would say, Meatloaf's Bat Out of Hell is my go-to karaoke song.
Okay.
If somebody forces me into that situation...
I like the fact that you just said forces, and yet should they force you, you're then on stage for about 12 minutes.
Well, here's the story. As any Meatloaf fan will tell you, there are two versions of Bat Out of Hell. There's the 9-minute version and there's the 5-minute version. Right. And of course, those of us who care about Meatloaf only accept the 9-minute version. Why? Don't edit Meatloaf. Jesus. And I once got thrown out of a bar. I was in New York and I just finished recording an album and I was out celebrating with some friends and we got very drunk. I ended up on stage singing Meatloaf as karaoke, and the first 5 minutes went by and that was fine. And then the edit came in and I was outraged that they'd gone for the edited version. And so started expressing my outrage into the microphone using certain swear words that are less cool in America than they are in the UK, shall we say. This is the PG version of this story. And was thrown bodily out of the karaoke bar for doing this. But I felt like I stood up for something I believed in there. And I did. The other thing about that song for karaoke is that because there is a long intro, you've got plenty of time to, you know, have your last drink and kind of, you know, limber up and whatever else you need to do before you get started.
So is that Frank Turner's most diva moment ever, losing his shit because they put the edit of Meatloaf on when you were doing karaoke?
I'd like to think I'm not very diva-ish, but, you know, there comes a time in every person's life when they have to draw a line.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
All right, well, I want to ask you about intros with your music, Frank, and from going way back to, you know, the early days of doing stuff with Lee Joke A Million Dead, through to what you're doing now. Over that time, we've seen the way that people listen to music change dramatically.
Sure.
Has that impacted on your approach to songwriting, and specifically the intro, in regards to trying to hook people quickly?
I know what you mean. There's the whole "Don't Bore Us, Get to the Chorus" thing, and I read an article not too long ago that was sort of like doing a graph, essentially, of the amount of time between start of song and start of chorus over time, and it definitely goes down. And, you know, I guess the thinking is that we live in an age of extremely low attention spans, and if you want to blow people away on the radio or Spotify, whatever it is, you've got to get to the chorus. I mean, that putting it that way makes me uncomfortable. Do you know what I mean? Because I think that's quite unartistic, should we say.
I do think them things are leaning more towards a pop market.
Sure. Definitely. I mean, there are definitely people who will try and kind of spread that gospel through all areas of the music industry. Sure. I will say that. But I guess the sort of the other way of thinking about it, which I have thought about quite a lot, is that, like, so one of my songwriting kind of guiding lights is my favorite song by Black Flag is called Fix Me. And the whole song is 48 seconds long. And I don't really have any songs that are that short, but I do every time I write a song and it passes the 48 second minute mark, I think to myself, I'm dawdling. Do you know what I mean? It's like,
we've hit the minute mark. This ain't good.
Yeah, it's like, do you know what I mean? Cause, I guess my point is that one of the things that I feel that punk rock as a musical style brought to the world of music was the, at least the refocusing the idea that brevity matters and like succinctness is powerful. It's not completely original to that, because I mean, one of the things I find interesting, if you go back and listen to the early Beatles records, a lot of them are 2 minutes long, you know, and they were very, very short and to the point as songwriters, which I think is really powerful. And I, in a way, I spend more time thinking about the first three or four Beatles records for that reason, because I think that, you know, being succinct can be powerful in popular music. Yeah. So, you know, I do think about this kind of thing. The punk rock thing's interesting to me. It's like, you can tell artists who came up before punk. So the reason that Springsteen thinks that doing a 4-hour show is a good idea is because he came up before punk was a thing.
Yeah.
I love Springsteen, but I really don't want to see him play for 4 hours.
Yeah.
Like, Jesus Christ. I'm not sure I want to see anyone play for 4 hours.
Yeah.
I'm a busy man. So, you know, anyway, so, I mean, I do think about that, and there's definitely been... I used to have a habit in my songwriting of writing songs on my early records that took quite a while to get going, because I was doing this thing often which was sort of layering. You know, you start with the vocal and guitar, and then you bring a bit of piano, and then you bring the drums in, and then you bring this in and bring that in. And they were kind of... Their 0-60 speed, if you like, was quite slow. And I thought about that a lot on more recent records and was interested in songs that kind of hit the ground running a bit more. Not necessarily because that's inherently better, but just because I've done quite a lot of the other version.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
And that's the thing that you quite often notice live, when you're playing a song live, do you know what I mean? It's fine having one song with an extended intro, but if you're trying to bang songs together to get momentum going during a set, if every song then goes back to zero and then takes its while, you know, so I have thought about that. But I mean, you know, it's I'm resistant to the idea that I'm doing that because that will help me in the world of Spotify, shall we say.
Yeah.
Even though I guess it might not hurt me in the world of Spotify, but nevertheless, that's not my kind of primary motivation.
Yeah, well answered, Frank.
Thank
track
you.
Two the first song you remember hearing that had an emotional impact on you?
So I've slightly cheated in my answer to this. I picked the song Wrathchild by Iron Maiden. The real answer to this question is Ides of March by Iron Maiden, which is the introductory song on the album Killers. But it's about a minute long, and it's an instrumental piece. And it's just a kind of... It's a concerto, essentially, for the album. And then you land with Wrathchild. Essentially, I wasn't that interested in music, particularly for the first 10 years of my life. My parents were into sort of classical music, church music, that kind of thing. And, you know, pop radio at that period of time didn't do very much for me. And then I stumbled across the music of Iron Maiden. I was playing Games Workshop, because I'm a massive winner, with a friend of mine, and his older brother had his bedroom door was slightly open, and he had a Iron Maiden poster on the wall, and I thought it was something to do with Games Workshop. It looked like it was in that kind of territory, and I said to my friend, "Oh, that's cool," and he said, "Yeah, that's a band," and I said, get out of here. There's no bands that are cool enough to have, like, zombies on their posters or whatever. And he said, no, it's a band. So I told my dad, and my dad, this dates the story, incidentally. There used to be an R Price at Waterloo Station. Imagine that. And he went in and bought the only Maiden record they had on cassette there for me, and which was one of the only sort of, like, sort of considerate gestures my father ever made in my direction, and which he still to this day regards as being his central parenting error in life, because I got that cassette, I put it on, and it was like a light switch. It just, there was life before and life after. And you know, as time goes by, Rothschild happens to be a song about absent fatherhood in its way, which, you know, get your psychoanalysis notebook out there, but nevertheless, it was the sound, it was just the impact, the rage, the energy, it was just cool, it was just amazing, and I'd never heard music that cool before, and that was when my life just went off a damn different track forever.
Okay, so what would the emotion have been, Frank?
I think the emotion was mainly just kind of like giddiness. Do you know what I mean? Nothing had ever like landed with me emotionally or sonically like that before. You know, to me, before that, I think music was something that my old sister listened to, or, you know, Jason and Kylie or whatever, you know, or I Had the Tiger on a Car advert or something, yeah, like that, and none of which did very much for me. And it was just kind of really, really powerful. I think one of the other things, and a lot of people who are into more underground types of music will be familiar with this, was that it was mine. Do you know what I mean? I'd found it. Like, none of my friends knew about this. Like, I checked, do you know what I mean? I was sort of calling my friends going, have you heard, like, metal? And people were just like, what are you talking about? And it was just, you know, that sense of ownership is really important as well. But it felt like I sort of, yeah, joined a secret brotherhood somehow, or community, let's say. And it was one that was really kind of theoretical for a long time, because my parents wouldn't let me go to gigs. I didn't know anyone else listened to the music, and it was very much sort of my little sort of private thing. In fact, there was one of the more kind of, the second kind of light switch moment in my musical listening career, if you like, was when, so I got into Maiden, I got all their records on cassette and was like so into it. And then I was chatting with a distant cousin of mine at Christmas who'd sort of got wind of the fact I was into this. And he was like, there are other bands that sound like this. And I was like, no, how could that be? And he made me a cassette that had Judas Priest Painkiller on one side and AC/DC Thunderstruck on the other side. And it was, again, it was like the whole thing all over again. It was like, Jesus Christ. And then I discovered, you know, Kerrang! Magazine or whatever. And it was like, again, it's a whole world opening up. So yeah, it was just the biggest change in my life to date, and remains that.
What do you think it was about metal that just resonated with you?
Energy, I think. Do you know what I mean? It was just exciting. You know, and it was fast. It was definitely faster than any music I'd ever heard before. And, you know, the vocals are just like there, and they're just like, you know, now I spend my time going all around. And it was just like, wow, people can sing like this. And it was just, you know, for me, a lot of my taste in music is quite physical, in the sense that, like, what I love about punk rock and hardcore and metal and all that kind of thing is the kind of, it makes me feel very physical, very involved, very energetic and all the rest of it. But even like the way that I sing, I'm often told by sound guys, for somebody who's in the sort of more acoustic folk world to the extent that I am, I sing incredibly loudly. And that's because I learned to sing in hardcore bands. Do you know what I mean? So, but that's it. For me, singing is about pushing it all out. Do you know what I mean? It's just like, rah! And like, it's not about kind of whispering like Nick Drake into a microphone. It's about like purging almost, do you know what I mean? And I sort of got a sense of that from that music.
Track three. The song reminds you of your time at school.
So I was shipped off to a boarding school when I was 12 years old. 12, 13. I took a scholarship exam because my parents wanted me to be the kind of person who went to one of those schools, or they wanted to be the kind of people who had a son who went to one of those schools. I in all honesty, don't really... My memory is that I wasn't entirely clear what was going on. I just got told to take this exam and went, okay, and then passed, which, cool. And then I sort of remember kind of arriving for the boarding part of it and going, okay. And then my parents kind of left And I was like, when are they coming back? And they were like, oh, in, you know, 2 or 3 months' time. And I was like, what the fuck? And so it was a very discombobulating experience. And then there's the whole social side of it. I went to Eton College, and I really didn't like the people I went to school with, or indeed the political culture around that. Although that's a slightly anachronistic word, in the sense that when I was 12, 13 years old, I'm not sure that I quite grasped the politics of it. It just didn't feel like a good shout to me. And I came from a different place to most of the kids who were there. And I sort of hated it immediately. I was very unhappy. That was just around the time that I'd started listening to punk rock. I was really into Nirvana, and Kurt Cobain referred to Nirvana as a punk band quite a lot. And I went, okay. And a friend of mine's uncle told me to buy The Clash and The Sex Pistols. So I bought those, and I thought they were cool. And then, you know, as you do in that kind of, in the Green Day and Offspring was starting to become a thing. So I was kind of moving into that world. And then around the time that I got sent to that school, I discovered, you know, Black Flag. And it was like, and it sort of became a bit of a life raft in a way.
There couldn't have been many people listening to Black Flag at Eton.
There were none, essentially. Well, no, that's not strictly true. There were two of us. There was me and my mate Chris, who, and we were best friends through school because we were having a similar experience. Neither of us were pleased to be there, shall we say.
Yeah.
You know, initially, like a lot of people, I guess it was the kind of the snotty rejectionist, you know, NOFX or whatever as well, and Descendants, Black Flag. And I mean, I listened to a lot of stuff. I listened to a lot of Discharge and GBH and stuff like that as well. The song that I've picked for this is a song by a band called Propagandhi, who are a Canadian punk band who I came across probably when I was about 14 or 15. At a guess through one of the Epitaph or Fat Records samplers would have been where I first heard them. But what I loved, and indeed still love, about Propagandhi is they have a kind of literacy and intelligence to their lyrics, which is just orders of magnitude. It's just miles away from the rest of the punk world, and indeed pretty much all other music that I'm familiar with.
Yeah.
The first Propagandhi song I ever heard opens with the line, "Publicly subsidized, privately profitable, the anthem of the upper tier, the puppeteer untouchable." And it was just like, sorry, excuse me? Like, what? And you know, and it was just, and because of course at the same time I had started reading anarchist books, I'd started reading, you know, everything and Howard Zinn and Chomsky and all the rest of it, and it was just, it was that kind of stuff kind of set to music, and it was just hugely powerful to me on that level. So I got hard into punk rock and anarchism at that point in time. But the song that I picked for this is a song called "I Was a Preteen McCarthyist," and it's a Propagandhi song from their first record, "How to Clean Everything," but no, possibly from their second record. Hold on, I can't quite remember. Doesn't really matter. The thing that I loved about it is that there's this moment at the end of the song where he suddenly kind of goes into more emotional and less intellectual territory for a second, and he says, "Maybe you're a lot like me, identified for 14 years without a choice, and terrified on the morning that you woke up to realise that when you jump ship, you either swim for shore or you drown, so don't let the fuckers drag you down." And it was just like, in the midst of this kind of like anger and you know, intellectual engagement and all this kind of thing, trying to deal with the situation I was in, it was like somebody just reached out and went, "And also your heart." Do you know what I mean? And it was just like, it makes me tear up even talking about it. And that song will always be just gigantically important to me on that level.
Was you playing at that point? Had you got a guitar or?
I had a guitar, and my friend Chris, who I mentioned earlier, we sort of put a little band together, which went through various iterations and terrible band names, and indeed a ska phase, if I'm honest with you.
Come on, reel some names off. Give me some names.
The worst one. Now I've got to tell this story, because if I don't explain it, it's going to sound ridiculous. There's a band called Goldfinger, ska punk band called Goldfinger, and they have a song of theirs where they kind of name all the great punk bands. He's like, you know, the Sex Pistols, the Clash, the Damned, and then he goes, blah, 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 and says one that's kind of hard to understand what he says. And I now know as an adult that he says Bad Religion, right, but in a slightly comedy Spanish accent for some reason. But we thought he said Badger Doritos, so we called ourselves Badger Doritos.
Loving that.
But the idea being that we were already cited in a song about great punk bands, and therefore, you know, we'd sort of like jump the queue, as it were. We were fucking awful as well. I stumbled across some of the recordings the other day, which will never see the light of day if, as long as I fucking live. So we were playing from a pretty early age, yeah.
So what did you want to? What did you want? Obviously, I like to ask guests like if they enjoyed school, and it sounded like, you know, from what you said, it wasn't the greatest experience.
I mean, I guess the one thing I say about that is that, like, I was intelligent enough at the time and now to recognise that one of the philosophical issues with those places is that the education they provide is fucking amazing. Do you know what I mean? That's kind of why it's a problem, in a way, is that it's, like, it's restricted to moneyed access, which it shouldn't be. But nevertheless, having gone through it, and indeed, you know, my parents didn't pay for me to go there. That's the point of the scholarship thing. But, like, you know, I was very well educated and I'm very grateful for that in its way. The issue is more to do with the sort of broader social access to that,
sure.
You know. I did enjoy the academic side of it. I just hated the social side of it because, I mean, I guess for a long time I would have said the sentence, everyone I went to school with was a cunt. And if you'll excuse the language. And I'm sort of old enough now to recognise that's not really true in the sense that there were lots of people who it was different individuals. I mean, there were definitely some people there who had some really unpleasant takes on the world. But then a lot of them were raised by unpleasant parents. So, I mean,
sure.
What are you going to do? But yeah, the experience. I mean, the thing that happened for me during school was that about halfway through, whilst getting into all this punk, I discovered the London hardcore scene. As in, there were people putting on underground punk shows and hardcore shows in London, and I could get there and I could go there, and it was all access. And the thing that I loved about it, and that will always be my favourite thing about punk rock, was that you became a member of the scene by showing up, and that was it. You didn't have to be cool. You didn't have to be in the know or good looking or anything like that. If you showed up and you were into it, you were part of the scene, and that was it. So from when I was about 16 onwards, I just went to London all the time. I stopped going home for school holidays and stuff, and started bunking off and just spent as much time as I could on the London punk scene.
What did you want to be when you was at school?
a punk. I mean, yeah, I guess what I wanted to be was kind of what I am now. I mean, I've been very fortunate in my life to have kind of quite a clear sense of direction from a pretty early age. I mean, obviously that's evolved over time. When I was 10, I wanted to be in Iron Maiden and be in this kind of stadium metal band. And then when I was about sort of between about 16 and 20, I probably wanted to be in like a super anarcho hardcore crust band who never played venues with stages, and do you know what I mean? I wanted to be in Catharsis or whatever. And then, you know, it's kind of evolved over time as my music and my understanding of the world and all the rest of it has changed as well. But that's definitely, it's been a pretty consistent ambition.
Well, you mentioned the education at school was good, and you said, you know, not so much the social side of things, but what about the creative side of things? Was that encouraged at all at school?
There was a band practice room that me and my friends kind of monopolised because no one else was really interested in it. And I've got to give them credit for that. You know, there was a drum kit and some amps in there which we could use. But we weren't encouraged, I wouldn't have said, to do that.
Sure.
There was a lot of... I mean, you know, again, one of the things about it is that, you know, when they get speakers for their school societies, they get, like, insanely high-profile people or whatever. Which is cool, but again, why are those kids getting it and not any other kids, you know? I mean, I wouldn't say that we were encouraged to do it, to do the kind of music that we were trying to do.
Yeah.
You know, Knee Jerk was kind of like pretty aggressive music, and we'd certainly got told off for screaming in the rehearsal room quite a lot.
Well, there you go. It makes you a punk, that. Right there, you're a punk.
Yeah, right. Totally. Well, the punkest thing I ever did at school, so, oh, Christ, I can't believe I'm about to tell this story. They had morning assembly every morning at, like, I guess, like 8:30 or whatever in a school hall. And they'd have, you know, a speaker or someone would play some music or whatever. And I can't really remember if you were asked to do this or if we had volunteered to do this, but we decided we were going to do one of those and play a grindcore set, which we did. And like my mate Chris, who was on guitar, like wore a dress, you know, and I wore like eyeliner. And I think I had like Poser written on my chest in black lipstick and all this kind of thing. And it proper like
yeah.
Grindcore kind of stuff. for like 10 minutes in front of the whole school, and like everybody kind of laughed, screamed, threw stuff at us, hated us, which was the point. Do you know what I mean? We were trying to like assault people sonically, I guess would be the way of saying it. And like, we were pretty kind of untouchable, not in a good way. Do you know what I mean? After that event. Yeah, it was, I mean, I look back on it and kind of can't quite believe we did that, but we did.
Brilliant. What was the first record you remember buying from a record shop, Frank?
well, this is a strange one because, like, first of all, it depends how militant you're being about the word record there.
Oh, no, it can be, obviously, CD or cassette.
Yeah. So, I mean, the choice that I've made for this is Quarter Light Sneeze by Tori Amos. And what I'm putting down here is definitely cassette singles in the cardboard sleeve. You know what I'm talking about?
Just push them out.
Yeah, I know, and they, you know, two songs, and you'd have to turn them over and all the rest of it, and rewind them.
It was great for the B sides, that, because you had to listen to the B side, so you could turn it over and listen to the A side on the other
side. Exactly, and there were some great B sides back then. But yeah, my older sister gave me three bands that I was into, kind of as I was getting into Maiden. They were the kind of like the tempering to that part of my music taste, and that was Levellers, Counting Crows, and Tori Amos, and particularly Quarter Light Sneeze, because it was dumb. It's actually produced by Trent Reznor, that track, and so I remember. Yeah, he did all the beats and production on that song, and I remember that sort of being kind of like validation or like permission. Do you know what I mean? Because I was already starting to identify as like a metalhead.
Yeah.
I quite liked Tori Amos. But it was like, oh, Trent Reznor's on this song. I'm allowed that one.
Yeah.
So I can't swear to you that it was the first record I bought, but it feels like it. Something around there. I mean, certainly it was one of the first things I bought that wasn't an Iron Maiden cassette.
Yeah. Hello. I've interrupted the podcast again, haven't I? Sorry. It won't take a sec. All I want to say is, the songs that we're talking about in this podcast, if we can't play them, it's just because of the regulations regarding playing licensed music and such. So if you want to hear the songs, just go over to Spotify and search Off the Beat and Track Podcast, and you can listen to all the songs because I've put playlists up for each of these. If you can't find it on there, I'll send links on all the social media accompanying each episode. So you've just got to press that one button and you can go through.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
And you can enjoy all the songs that our guest picks. Anyway, I'll shut up, get back to the podcast. See you on the other side. How was it, those early days of discovering music? And like you say, you mentioned the Levellers there. How was that to sort of fast forward however many years and record with the Levellers?
Oh, yeah. I mean, insane. And like my adult life has featured quite a lot of like fucking hell moments like that, you know, touring with the Levs. I'm reasonably good friends with Adam Duritz from Cat and Crows now.
Really?
And yeah, I know. And like, like, it's funny, every time he texts me, I still kind of go, when my phone pings. Do you know what I mean? And the thing that's funny is, so when I got the tour with the Levelers in 2008, it was the first time I met those guys. And my sister texted me, my older sister texted me and was just like, fuck you, I was into the Levelers first. You're not allowed to be their friend, kind of thing. But we sort of made our peace with that, and I introduced her to him and all the rest of it. And then a couple of years later, I met Adam for the first time. I was in Australia at a festival, and I took a photo with me and him, and I texted it to my sister, and I knew it was like 4 a.m. in the UK. So I texted it to my sister, then called her, and she was like, hello? And I went, check your phone, and hung up. And she then looked at the picture, and then she texted me back, being like, we're dead. We're over. You and me. This is done. Do you know what I mean? She was furious. But, like, you know, I've been fortunate enough to meet a lot of musicians that I had posters of on my wall when I was a kid, you know, and that's a really cool thing.
We was talking a little while ago. I know we've got a mutual friend in Scroobius Pip. And, and Pip and I were discussing Counting Crows as it was like the ultimate breakup album of the early 90s, August and everything after.
But, oh yeah,
but it's the on the live album. I'm just nerding out on Counting Crows a little bit.
Yeah, so that's breakup. Let's go.
Raining in Baltimore on the live album where he just wigs out with his voice. Ah, where he just sings how much he needs a raincoat.
Oh yeah,
like fucking hell.
Yeah, he's amazing. And, well, talking about B-sides, I was talking about earlier, a huge influence on my whole career has been the fact that on the early Counting Crows singles, the B-sides would be reworkings of album tracks done in a different arrangement and a different style. So there'd be like a rock version of a folk song or a folk version of a rock song, whatever, and that was the B-sides on those cassette singles. And it was a really early introduction to me to the idea that arrangement and songwriting are two slightly different things. And you can take a song and you can do a heavy version or a quiet version or a fast version or a slow version, and it's still the same song, but, you know, you've done a different thing with it. And that's the thing I got off Counting Crows, and the thing I do all the time, you know, is, like, work up different versions of my own songs. So that was a big thing. The other thing I was going to mention, by the way, and I am now showing off for the next 30 seconds.
Go
I'm
for it.
Off. We played a show in Baltimore a couple of years ago, and it was an outdoor show, well, kind of in a sort of pavilion, like under a sort of circus top type thing, but it was raining. And halfway through the set, I had a little solo break when my band went off, and I was like, I can't not do this.
You can't not do that.
Yeah, it's like, it is quite literally raining in Baltimore. So, but this story gets better, because so I played Raining in Baltimore, and the crowd was into it and all the rest of it. And I came off stage, picked up my phone, Adam Duritz. Right, and it turns out Adam Duritz's brother was in the audience.
Fuck off! That's amazing.
And had called Adam, and Adam had heard some of it, and he sent me a text saying, "Nice work on the cover." And you know, I did a little backflip or whatever. It was amazing.
What a moment! That's incredible. Yeah.
That was pretty cool.
All right, Frank, let's do track 5, which is the song that soundtracked your years clubbing.
Okay, well, so clubbing's an interesting word for me. When I was a young kid, you know, I'm guessing that we're roughly in a similar age bracket here.
Older than you, Frank.
Okay, well, there we go. So you'll remember that when we were younger, there was definitely more tribalism among youth people when it came to music, right? Incidentally, a word that I'm really keen to revive is Grebo. I don't know if you ever used the word Grebo when you were a kid.
Let me just tell you this. I've run an alternative nightclub for 30 years, Frank.
Yeah.
And when I first started going there as a clubber, before I got involved in it, in DJing there, all the bands I would go and see would be the Senseless Things, the Levelers, Carter, the Wonder Stuff.
Yeah.
Grebo bands.
Yeah.
That's what we called them, Grebo bands.
It was
we all had that look. It was like dreads, shorts, you know, baggy tees, long sleeve, like band t-shirts. That's what we call Grebos in Essex anyway.
Right. Well, I mean, I guess in my day, Grebo just essentially meant anyone who wasn't into like pop and dance music and clubbing. So you know, a lot of dreads. Basically, it meant someone who'd go to Reading Festival, not Glastonbury Festival, kind of thing. Do you know what I mean? And it was, you know, and incidentally, this is a major thing for me. Is I've explained this to younger people or indeed Americans a lot. The reason why the Prodigy was so important is that they were the unifying thing for alternative music in 100%. The broadest sense. And it was the first time that metal kids and punk kids and clubbers ended up in the same place and realized they had something in common, and it was so powerful. I remember that vividly from like the late 90s when I was a kid. It was the first time I sort of allowed myself to listen to a band that had a drum machine, you know. But then, so this goes back to when I was a kid. So we talk about clubbing, like when I was a teenager, clubbing to me was like the enemy. Do you know what I mean? Like techno, anything kind of dance, all that kind of thing. It was like, fuck that, I'm gonna go and see like bands that sound like crass. Do you know what I mean? And it was like the idea of knowing how to dance was kind of like bad in some way. So that wasn't really a thing. In my early 20s, or mid-20s, I spent a lot of time sort of living at a bar called Nambuka in North London. And the guys there ran a club night called Frog that was the biggest indie club night in London. So it was Dave Danger and Sensible J and all the rest. And they ran this. And I wasn't technically employed, but I was definitely part of the kind of the inner circle, as it were. I mean, I remember that I would go down every week and I'd help put up, you know, backdrops and flyers and stuff. And quite often my job during the night would be, how best to put this in a way that's legal, running certain things from the dressing room to the DJ booth as required. And
bottles of water,
you know,
right?
Bottles of water, exactly that. But so, you know, that was my clubbing world. And it was indie clubbing. Do you know what I mean? It wasn't quite...
This comes up a lot, Frank, because so many musicians and DJs and stuff like that I speak to are like, I didn't really do that kind of shiny, chromey kind of high street clubbing. We just went to the dirty, sweaty indie nights. And
I mean, I think looking back, I obviously was a bit too young and into a different type of music to have anything to do with like the free party scene, for example, in the 80s and the 90s. But like, there's a part of me that sort of wishes that I could have done it, in the sense that that type of dance music and of electronic music, it seems really anarchic and really punk to me in a way that I quite like. Even if the music isn't 100% to my taste, I think, do you know what I mean? That whole kind of approach is really exciting to me.
Are you talking about like Whirly Gig and Osric Temples?
Yeah, the raves and the free parties, and the whole kind of calling an answering machine and driving with the motorway.
Oh, right,
But even kind of talking about, I've read about like, you know, early Ministry of Sound history and that kind of thing, and it's interesting to me. It sounds like it was an exciting moment musically. Anyway, I'm going off topic. So indie clubbing was my thing. And, you know, I never really danced. I'd take quite a lot of kind of dance-related substances and then just sort of do massages and talk a lot of bollocks in the dressing room. But the one song that landed with me that I've picked for this is a song called The Rat by The Walkmen. It was a kind of, you know, indie club land hit, as it were, in the mid-2000s. But it came out just at the moment that Million Dead broke up and I went solo, and I was feeling quite kind of burned by that experience, and I'd sort of made a decision to sort of leave hardcore behind as a musical style for the time being, at any rate. And, you know, I'd found this new group of friends that was centred around Nambuka and centred around Frog, and that was all very important to me, but I definitely felt quite sort of like chewed up and spat out in a way. Do you know what I mean? And then I heard that song, you know, You've Got a Nerve to Be Asking a Favour. And that line where it says, when I used to go out, I would know everyone that I saw. Now I go out alone if I go out at all. And I remember it just like, just fucking landing in my soul and being like, that's my life. And indeed, it is one of the most beautiful pieces of guitar music that I know. It's so powerful and
the
euphoric.
Drums, Frank, the drums are off the fucking scale.
It's got to be exhausting.
You watch the video of him, he's just losing it. It's like, it's incredible.
It's such a great, great tune. And it's still, that's a song that puts me in a very specific time and place.
Yeah.
And that specific time and place is kind of coming up in the middle of the dance floor at the LA2. Do you know what I mean? So there you go.
Oh, wonderful. For track six, Frank, I'm going to ask you what your favourite song from an artist from your home county is.
You see, I've slightly cheated here because I'm not sure it's quite home county.
Okay.
You know, I grew up in Hampshire, and then I got shipped off to boarding school, and then I moved to London, and like I've essentially been quite nomadic since quite a young age. And one of the things, I put out a record in 2011 called "England Keep My Bones" that was a kind of looking at national identity. Boringly, I still have to say this, it's not a nationalist statement. I don't think anyone's better by virtue of being born anywhere. That's a ridiculous idea to me. But the thing was, like, I was touring so much. I did my first tour when I was 16 and basically haven't really stopped until coronavirus. I was touring so much, and then it was just like, a lot of the, particularly around that time, I'd started touring America and I'd tour it on my own. So I'd be the only English person in a crowded room every night, night after night after night after night. And it just sort of makes you wonder why it is you understand the rules of cricket and other people don't, or whatever, you know. And it's not because I think that's better. It's just it's made me think about England and Englishness and how that has affected me for better and indeed for worse. So I was thinking about this a lot. And at that time, I started getting into folk music. I'd used the word folk from the start of my solo career, but it was much more kind of ideological and aspirational than it was musicological, should we say, other than the fact I had an acoustic guitar.
Sure.
But, you know, and then I sort of found out, oh, there is actually such a thing as like real English folk music, and there's a whole scene and people who know about it and the rest of it. And some of that scene's quite worthy. It's quite kind of museum custodian, do you know what I mean, in a way that doesn't do masses for me. But some of it is really wonderful and beautiful. So I picked a song by Martin Simpson called Never Any Good. And it's just... It was a song that I heard quite early in my journey into folk music that just feels, in a really nice way, feels very English, you know. And it, you were never any good with money. You couldn't even hold a job. Not steady enough for the office. Not hard enough for the hod. Do you know what I mean? It's just this kind of really beautiful portrait of his dad. It moves me deeply, and it's got a very trad English sort of finger picking pattern and all the rest of it. But it's just a wonderful song.
Well, we put together a Spotify playlist, Frank, to accompany this podcast, so I'll ensure that that's on there. I had a listen as well in the week, and it's a beautiful record. That
there's something. This isn't really quite related to what we're talking about, but something that I really love about a lot of kind of folk music that I'm interested in as a writer at this point in my life. An awful lot of popular music, including quite a lot of punk rock, is almost exclusively about experiences and emotions that you have between the ages of 16 and 25. And I understand why, because things can be quite powerful then, but it's like, I think there's something slightly dishonest about, and I'm not going to name names, but I've heard songs by big punk bands about high school, and it's like, you're all in your 40s. Why are you talking about high school? It's got fuck all to do with your life. And first of all, let people who are in that age group have those songs. Yeah. But also, the reason I love Loud On Main Right or The National or Leonard Cohen or The Hold Steady or whatever is that it's people who sing about adult experience, you know, because I certainly wouldn't have called myself a fully formed adult at 25, Jesus Christ, you know. And that's one of the things I love about this song, is it's like it's kind of a grown-up sentiment to explore in a song. Kind of, it's about regarding your father as a real person rather than a sort of icon in a way. And it's, yeah, I find that powerful.
Okay, last track, Frank, a song that many may not know that you would like them to hear.
I picked a song by Sister Rosetta Tharpe called Didn't It Rain. My knowledge of Sister Rosetta Tharpe is comparatively recent. I'm something of a music nerd. On bookshelves, you can see in the corner of this shot, are endless, endless music biographies, music history books. I'm the kind of person that I'll read a music biography about a band I don't even like because I'm just interested. Do you know
likewise,
what I mean? Yeah, you know, it's just, it's the history. If somebody sold a million records, then I'm interested in how they did that.
Totally.
You know, and if they've had that impact on culture. So, I was reading a lot of books about, I'm very obsessed with Elvis. There he is.
But for those that are listening, like that, he's not in the room with Frank. Frank just showed us his tattoo of Elvis.
I do have quite a large cardboard cutout of Elvis in my house, but he's upstairs. Life size, I should say. I don't know if you know, he was the king of rock and roll.
Ah, right. Anyway, okay.
Yeah. And he really was. And people who doubt that statement should read Peter Guralnik's 2-volume biography of Elvis, because if that doesn't make you a fan.
Let's chat Elvis quickly, because I'm a huge Elvis fan. Young Elvis, fat Elvis, what are you saying?
Different moments. I'm not saying that it was consistently brilliant. Certainly his sort of Hollywood era was like really a lot of it. Early Elvis, the really early Doors stuff is amazing. Hound Dog still sounds punk as fuck to me. Do you know what I mean? Just in both in terms of the production and the playing. It's just so aggressive.
Like what you said about the Beatles with them 2-minute songs. That's what Elvis was doing as well.
Right. And the other thing about Elvis, and this goes back to the thing I said earlier about arrangement and songwriting being slightly different things. Elvis didn't write songs. Elvis was the master arranger. And legend has it, he used to get sent 200 acetates of songs to record, and he would listen to all 200, and he'd pick number 198, despite the fact his manager and various other people had been front-loading the ones they thought he should do on the top of the pile. Ignored all of that. And if you want to hear why Elvis is important, listen to the two versions of Hound Dog that are out there. With all due respect to Big Mama Thornton, Elvis's version is the one that changed the world, and there's a reason for that, and you can hear it in real time, you know. And then 68 Comeback Special is amazing. Early Vegas Elvis was brilliant. Vegas Elvis has been kind of like coloured by the fact that by the end it was kind of terrible.
Yeah.
But at the beginning of early, there are bootlegs out there. Early Vegas Elvis was unbelievable.
Huge. Absolutely brilliant.
First person to ever use an intro tape live. Elvis at Vegas.
Really?
Yeah, and it was the Thus Spake Zarathustra, you know, the thing that's at the beginning of 2001, Space Odyssey. He had that as his walk-on music, and it was the first time a band had ever done that, ever.
Nice. Have you seen the documentary, The Elvis 56? It's all just photographs and voiceover, and it's just him on his first tour, and whoever the photographer is, without a shadow of a doubt, the most beautiful man on the planet at that point, without a shadow of a doubt.
Completely.
Unbelievable.
And as the old adage goes, you know, he was a white truck driver from the deep south who dressed like a gay man and sung like a black man.
Yeah.
It's just kind of like, that's out there. I mean, obviously, Little Richard, more out there, and there is a strong argument to be made that musicologically, Little Richard was more important and all the rest of it, and I'll back that. But there is it matters that Elvis had the impact that he did. The reasons why, namely that he was white, we can talk about how that's problematic on some levels, but the simple fact of the matter is that Elvis fucking annihilated the world, do you know what I mean? And that matters.
I can't imagine what it must have been like to have just seen him at that point. Them early shows or snippets of him, if you know, you could get access to a television to see it. It must have been beyond punk. It must have just been
right. Well, this is the thing I think about quite a lot. I love Black Flag, as we've already talked about, but one of the things about Black Flag is you have to slightly listen into the context historically, you know, because the production's pretty bad and you have to remember where music was at that point and blah, 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 blah. You don't have to do that with early Elvis. Like I say, you put on Hound Dog, it's like getting punched straight in the face. Mm. Even now, in 2020, it's like getting punched in the face. It's just so strong. And what it must have been like to have been living in a world of Bing Crosby and Perry Como and how much that doggy in the window, and then have Hound Dog come on your stereo. It's just like, holy shit.
Totally.
You know, it's amazing.
Well, let's move away from Elvis and back to your choice. Anyway, we can sidetrack then.
The reason I mention Elvis is that in reading biographies about him, and indeed Johnny Cash, the sister Rosetta Tharpe gets mentioned quite a lot, and I was like, well, who the fuck is that? I've never heard of this person. I went off and there's recordings exist, and she, you know, the whole kind of endless chase for like the sort of godparents of rock and roll, the original rock and roll record, and was it Rocket 88 or whatever, and all this kind of thing is kind of pointless to a degree. But she was definitely a forerunner. I end up writing a song about her and then making a history podcast about her as well. So I've got quite deep into her career. And you know, she was from a Pentecostal background where they do the speaking in tongues thing, and she played a white Gibson SG and essentially channeled the whole speaking in tongues thing into the way that she played her guitar, and made a very energetic kind of gospel, which essentially started morphing into rock and roll Avon Electra. She released a record in 1938 called Rock Me, which is the first recorded use of the word rock to do with music. So, you know, there's something in that. And indeed, it was sold like 500,000 copies. It was a big hit. She was the first person of any gender or color to headline a stadium show in the 1950s. She got married. Her second marriage was at a stadium show. She indeed booked the show before she had a husband lined up. Which is kind of amazing. She gave herself 6 months to find a husband after booking the stadium. It was amazing. She was there. It is possible that she was bisexual. It's sort of difficult to tell and feels slightly voyeuristic to me to pry too hard into that. But she was essentially, you know, just incredibly iconoclastic. And one of the reasons she's not so well known today, because she essentially gets written out of the script once Elvis and Jerry Lee Lewis and Carl Perkins and people arrive. There's a number of reasons for that. Some of them have to do with race. But it's also just, she was just so iconoclastic. She just didn't fit. By the 1950s, she was a middle-aged, gay, black woman with a gospel background who was still quite religious. When you're talking about Elvis selling records to teenagers and bobby soxers and all that kind of thing, it's just like, what the fuck? From just a marketing point of view. But nevertheless, her music was hugely powerful. And Didn't It Rain is just a great example of that. And indeed, there's this wonderful piece of footage, which is in the 1960s, when young kind of English nerds started getting into American blues. So they got people like Muddy Waters over for a tour, and there was this huge, and it, English and Dutch people started getting kind of black Mississippi American musicians who'd been completely forgotten and ignored in America. They started getting them over for tours in their later years. And Sister Rosetta Tharpe did a tour of England in the mid-1960s where she played on abandoned train platforms because it was shortly after the beaching cuts. So there's this, and it's on YouTube, one of them. It's just outside Manchester, and there's a railway platform, and the audience is on one side and she's on the other, and she just plays, and she's fucking amazing. And you can see it's all these like 17-year-old super dorky English kids, white kids with notepads, and then she's up there rocking out with her SG, and it's just beautiful. And it was filmed for a TV special, and that is on YouTube. So
aside from that, if people want to check out the podcast, where can they find that?
I did this record called No Man's Land, which is a history record, and it's all about historical figures and female historical figures. And to write somebody's life with justice in 3.5 minutes is a challenge. It's obviously the challenge I set myself, but I thought I would do a podcast to go deep into the history behind these people as a mark of respect. Do you know what I mean? And indeed to get real historians involved as well, who actually know what they're talking about. So it's the podcast called Tales from No Man's Land, and it's on places that people can listen to podcasts.
Okay. Well, we'll add this to the bio when we put this up as well, so people can go and check that out. Frank, it appears there's light at the end of the tunnel somewhere in this pandemic we're going through. When we come out of this and things are safe, what's lined up for you, mate?
Well, I mean, one of the difficult things, as I'm sure you know, is that like the easing of lockdown is not a universal thing. And my industry, the live music industry, is not having its lockdown eased currently. There's a lot of people having conversations about things like drive-in shows and all that kind of thing. And I appreciate and sympathize with and indeed applaud the impulse to do that. At the same time, I think that a lot of all of this stuff, lockdown and these ideas, highlight the fact that gathering is the center of the live experience. We want to be, you and I both, we want to be in a sweaty punk club bouncing to the Senseless Things or whatever. Do you know what I mean?
Totally.
That's what we want, you know, and we want to have beer spilled on us and for someone to crowd surf over us, all of which feels a bit not cool during a pandemic.
Yeah.
So I don't know when that kind of thing's going to return to normal, but I'm enjoying the fact that we can go outside a bit more. And I went to see my mum the other day and it was good. It was a positive thing in my life. So, I'm happy that we're kind of, seems like things are starting to ease up a bit. I mean, whether or not there'll be second waves or this kind of thing, obviously that impacts the live industry as well. How are you going to book a tour if you don't know if it can happen? Sure. But I mean, I rest assured that I will play shows as soon as I humanly can.
Wonderful. I look forward to that as well. Frank, thanks so much for today.
It's been lots and lots of fun. I've told stories that I've not told before in any public format, and I'm now wondering whether I should have done so.
Well, I've got it now. It's going out.
Yeah, it's all good. Publish and be damned. Publish and be damned.
Thanks loads, Frank.
Cheers, man.
There you go.
Cool.
Frank Turner. What an absolute gent. Had so much fun doing that. And, oh, man, the Counting Crows story, like, that's a moment, right? I hope you've all enjoyed that as much as I did recording that with Frank. Yeah, one of my absolute faves that was, and a real pleasure to also sit down with someone who's, you know, whose work I've admired for years and years. And yeah, so I hope you got as much joy out of it as I did. Also, as I mentioned at the beginning, if this is your first time listening, then go and have a look in the archives, because you'll see stacks of podcasts from people that you like, and I'm sure you're going to want to hear them talk about their records that have been really important in their lives. All right, I'm done. Have a lovely week. Stay safe, and I'll see you soon. Thanks again. Bye-bye. Oh, yeah. Sorry. I've butted in yet again. I just want to quickly tell you about this magazine. It's called Pod Bible. Now, Pod Bible is the new essential guide to podcasts. It's put together alongside Spotify and Acast, and it's a one-stop shop to tell you all about the podcasts you maybe know about, but definitely about a load of the podcasts that you probably don't know about that we think you should know about. I mean, in the first edition, there's interviews with Adam Buxton, interviews with Craig Parkinson, there's features on Jade Adams, and there's just an abundance of information about so many exciting podcasts that are out there. Also, Spotify have given us these amazing little codes. So if you do get a print copy, you can just turn on your Spotify on your phone, scan the little code, and it just automatically opens up the podcast on your listening device. How good's that? If you haven't managed to get a print copy, then just go over to www.podbiblemag.com and read it online, because the digital version is all over there and it's all free. So every other month there'll be a new edition out. So go and have a look and support us on the social medias as well. Podbiblemag.com.
It's Off the Beaten Track podcast on the Distraction Pieces Network with me, Stu Whiffin.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.